WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Public schools are in trouble in much of America. There's serious trouble in New York, where gangs, drugs, and guns have turned some schools into frightening places to be. My guest, Joseph Fernandez, has been the chancellor of New York City's public schools for the past 3 years. As a teenager growing up in New York City, he belonged to gangs and used drugs. Now he oversees a system with almost 1 million students. He formerly was the superintendent of public schools in Miami. His efforts to make the New York schools responsive to the needs of the time have made him a very controversial figure. He started a condom distribution program in the schools. He got rid of tenure for principals and waged an assault against the bureaucracy. Fernandez is Puerto Rican, and he's led the charge for a multicultural curriculum. The most controversial part of the curriculum relates to promoting respect for gays and lesbians. One school board refused to adopt the curriculum. It's still in the revision stage. I asked Fernandez to describe how it deals with homosexuality.
There's a section called Family Structures, and the idea there was that in this new nuclear age, we have different family structures than the traditional one mother, one father family structure. In fact, many children in our city schools across this country come from a single parent home. Many of them come from surrogate parents. Some of them do come from parents where there are two fathers or two mothers. And the idea was to start young with the children and try to eliminate any biases that the children would have if other children happen to come from these family structures. It was trying to teach tolerance.
So you're not teaching about homosexuality per se. You're just going to have examples there of households in which there are two women instead of a man and a woman as the couple, or two men instead of a husband and wife.
And in fact, while some people objected to the age appropriateness, we're saying it has to be done somewhere in the elementary grades. It doesn't necessarily have to be done in the first grade, but somewhere in grades 1 through 6.
Do you understand the fears of people who object to the curriculum, fears that children will have questions that they won't understand and that the teachers really won't be in a position to answer for that?
Yeah, but that's why you have extensive teacher training tied into it. But put yourself, take the other point of view. Students are, a common exercise in elementary schools is for students to draw a picture of their family and then show and tell about their family. What happens to that child that comes from a gay family? The burden that they carry with them in terms of intolerance is just insurmountable. It's very, very hard for these kids. We're trying to teach early on through education for students to be tolerant. We're not professing one lifestyle over another.
So I just want to get a sense of what's in the curriculum about single parents or about gay families. Is it just like pictures of different families in a book? Is it stories about different families that the children would read?
And again, a lot is left to the discretion of the teacher after they go through the training. But for example, it's an entire bibliography of over 600 books. Obviously, one of the books that's raised a lot of questions is the one called Heather Has Two Mommies. And it talks about the life of a young girl that's being raised by two lesbian mothers. But it's done in a very delicate way.
Now, multicultural curricula are really among the most controversial issues in the schools now. One of the criticisms is that we're paying too much attention to self-esteem, ethnic self-esteem, racial self-esteem, religious, sexual orientation. And we're paying so much attention to self-esteem that it's happening at the expense of, you know, basics like math and English. Well, I'm wondering, as someone who, like, dropped out of school yourself when you were young, and who kind of knows what it's like to be alienated from school, do you think that the schools with the multicultural curricula are paying too much attention to self-esteem?
No, look, I think that's part of the problem. We're still trying to operate our schools like we did 20, 25 years ago when the problems that our students are facing are different. We have to change the institution to meet the needs of the kids that are in our schools today. And it's not being done at the expense of other things. That's a straw dog that the people say you're not concentrating on reading and math and the other necessary academic subjects. Of course we are. But you also, in today's day and age, have to deal with health issues and social issues as well.
Let me move on to the issue of violence, which is such a nightmare in the schools now. And I think one of the more tragic stories I read recently was about the New York principal from Red Hook who had heard one of his students went home in tears, and he tried to find a student in a housing project, and the principal got shot in a drug shootout crossfire.
Yeah, that was Patrick Daly. That's one of many sad stories that are going on in our schools and in our school communities. And it's not just in New York City, but it's all around the country.
Certainly in Philadelphia, where I live, there's been a series of shootings in schools. What do you think we should be doing in city schools where violence is a problem? Do you want to see more police in schools, more metal screening so that kids can't come into schools with guns? Is that the approach we should be taking?
Well, I think that's a short-range approach. We're having to do it, obviously, because there's a comfort level that people get from the metal detectors, which is certainly not a perfect science, incidentally. It's not every kid that's detected. It's because you have 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 children coming into a high school at one time. You can't possibly use the metal detectors on every one of them. It's not like at the airports. These are handheld detectors. But people do get a comfort level from that, and I understand that, and they do get a comfort level with more security in the schools. But you have to get at the root causes. Many of our children traveling to and from school run into difficulty because neighborhoods are very much unsafe. There's a proliferation of guns out there that we have to somehow politically do something about. And we also, I think, have to get at some of the root causes in terms of teaching our kids how to resolve their conflicts in a more peaceful way. That's why peer mediation and conflict resolution programs are so important.
You've actually increased the budget for metal detectors, haven't you?
Yeah, but again, it's a reaction. We got money from the city. It's a reaction to, obviously, some students being injured and killed. We now have metal detectors in 41 schools, but I have 124 high schools, so we don't have them in every school. And even at that, the metal detectors, as I indicated, it's not a perfect science.
Yeah. Are there city cops in the schools?
In some schools, we have city cops, and others. I have the equivalent of the 7th largest police force in the country in my school's security department. We have over 2,500 school security officers. We have our own school security academy that they go through and train. They're not armed, but they're taught how to, in a preventative mode, how to deal with situations.
What do teachers say to you, teachers who are really afraid?
It's a major problem. Teachers are not only afraid for themselves, but they're afraid for their students. And in fact, just recently in the paper, I don't know if you noticed, the National Education Association made a plea to the new administration in terms of school safety to see if we can work together to come up with some solutions.
What would you like to see? What do you think are possible solutions?
Well, I think politically, guns have to be taken off the streets. Guns can't be made as easily accessible as they currently are. And our mayor, for example, has been screaming trying to get that sort of legislation passed. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that we have to be dealing with our students in terms of these conflict resolution programs.
Let me get to another program that you developed, and this was a condom distribution program, which earned you the nickname of King Condom, which I'm sure you're really thrilled about. Now, what's the status of that program now? Are condoms being distributed in New York's public schools?
They're not distributed. They're made available.
Made available, yeah, right. I know.
It's the wrong word, isn't it? Well,
yeah.
That's the word the opponents use. It makes it sound like it's condoms are being given out willy-nilly.
Yeah.
We have an AIDS epidemic that we're facing. Anyone that doesn't recognize that has their heads in the sand. Next year, it's projected there'll be 1 million teenage pregnancies in this country. So our adolescents are, in fact, having sex. Now, our HIV-AIDS instructional program stresses abstinence. It tells students, teenagers, that the only sure way of not getting the virus is by abstinence, the only sure way. However, if you're going to have sex, and knowing full well that the condoms are not infallible, it's a 14 to 17% failure rate, depending on which literature you read, we felt it was necessary to have condoms made available for those students that, in fact, wanted to use them.
So how does it work? If you're a student, how can you get a condom?
Well, first of all, there's six classes involved in HIV/AIDS. There are six required hours of instruction to take place for every high school student in our schools. And then there is a health resource room that is manned by volunteers that have been trained through the Academy of Medicine here in New York City. Each school is a little bit different. Some of them have the resource open every period of the day. Some of it just have it open during lunch period, before school, after school. Some of them are made available through where we have school clinics. But a student would go to one of these resource rooms and request the availability of condom. And with it, he would be given some literature, again, emphasizing abstinence, and again, also talking about the failure rate of condoms. And that would be it.
How are the prices? Are they competitive with the drugstores?
They don't pay for it.
Oh, that's free?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that's the advantage of getting through the school for a student over going to...
Well, not only that, you know, when you talk to students, many of them will not go to a drugstore to get it. Many of them are embarrassed by that.
Uh-huh.
Many of them can't afford it.
Right. You had a lot of opposition from the church.
Oh, of course, yeah. We recognize that, and opposition from other groups, not just the church. But it's very similar to, you know, it's deja vu when human growth and development sex education programs were put back in the, put in the schools in the 60s.
So how did you deal with the opposition? What was your strategy?
Well, we basically had a lot of meetings, information sessions. We sent our people out to parent groups. Incidentally, the United Parents Association, which is the largest parent organization in New York City, supports us on the HIV-AIDS condom availability program. So we did have a lot of support in it, and schools came into the program at different times. But over the last year now, every single school, high school that is, in New York City is in the program.
My guest is Joseph Fernandez, who's the Chancellor of Public Schools in New York, author of a new memoir called Tales Out of School. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joseph Fernandez, Chancellor of New York's Public Schools. You say in your new book that people always want schools to return to what schools were like back when they were young. And when people talk about improving the schools and making them better, what they're really thinking of is making those schools into what schools were like back when they were in school.
Mm-hmm.
Any chance you think we're ever going to return to the old days?
Well, I'm surprised you didn't say the good old days because the good old days weren't always good for some people. The good old days certainly weren't good for young African Americans. They certainly weren't good for Puerto Ricans in New York City. And I doubt very seriously if they were good even for recent other immigrant arrivals. But look, the reality of the matter is that the issues facing children in the cities today is totally different than it was 20 years ago. A large number of our kids come from a single-parent home. We have a lot of dysfunctional families out there. That's not to say that single-parent homes are dysfunctional. I want to be clear about that because they're very good family structures, too. But my point is that it's not the traditional Ozzie and Nelson, Harriet family, Ozzie and Harriet family out there like we used to have where students came home and somebody was there waiting for them. We have hundreds of thousands of latchkey students. We don't have the after-school programs that we used to have. So there's a lot of things missing in the lives of youngsters that have to go through the streets to get to their schools today. Plus all of the other things we've been talking about, the danger and the drugs and the mm-hmm. gangs and all of that violence.
So if we don't look back and try to make the schools into what they once were, then that means we have to look to a future which might be very different from anything we know. When you look ahead, what kind of models do you see in your mind?
Well, we see models like the model we just opened up in the Washington Heights area, which is a very dominant Dominican Republic area, with the Children's Aid Society, a collaboration where the school is open 7 days a week till 10 o'clock at night, and its use is a total community resource, including physical and counseling services, including parent training programs, including dental services. We see models where we're creating small high schools, 500 to 700 students, because our very large high schools are very impersonal, and students get lost in the numbers. And we see schools where teachers and students and parents are moving together in a cooperative learning model. We see schools that are ungraded schools in the early grades, and students move at their own rate of accomplishment in terms of understanding the, you know, the programs that we're putting in front of them. We see a lot of different things in the future, and a lot of that is happening right now. We see schools that are managed collaboratively by teachers and administrators and parents and community-based organizations. We see schools that are thematic in nature, that are focusing on a particular a theme that students have an interest in. Everything we're doing is tied into the research in terms of where at-risk kids and other children will be more successful in the schools.
What did school mean to you when you were young?
Well, it meant different things. And look, I don't want to put the burden of what happened to me totally on the schools, but a lot of it was because there was no connection between my community and the school. There was no connection between me and the school. It was a place I had to go to. You know, one of the sad experiences of my life is that I can only think about three or four teachers that I can remember that obviously made an impression on me. There was just that connection was missing. That's what we're trying to do, is reconnect our parents and our children back with the schools.
Were there people, either your parents or teachers, who tried to convince you to love school and to do your homework and so on?
I was very lucky because I was a good student in terms of the academics always came very easy to me. And so it was that part of it was easy for me. It was the social adjustment that was more difficult for me. You know, more often than not, I was a minority. I was generally not part of the mainstream, if you will. And you had to learn how to survive in that, which is fine. That's part of growing up in the city, and I don't regret that. I'll always be thankful for my, you know, my street smarts, if you will, that I learned while I was growing up in the city. But when I needed the connection to be made, it wasn't there. When I started getting involved, unfortunately, with drugs, the connection with school wasn't there of counseling to help me. When I wanted to leave school, there was nobody there except my parents trying to get me to stay. And those are the kind of things that I think we missed the boat on.
So when you were growing up and you really didn't care much about school, you were in a gang, you used drugs, you dropped out of school, you joined the Army, but you ended up kind of coming back to school, falling in love with math and becoming an educator. Where was the turnaround?
I think probably the military for me was the turnaround in terms that it brought some structure, some balance to my life. And incidentally, the military probably wouldn't have been available to me today. Because I was a high school dropout. The military, as you know now, is much more selective in terms of who they take. And certainly, my understanding, particularly with a volunteer force, which it was then too, they weren't going through the draft at that point, you know, would take high school dropouts and work with them. But even today, that's not available for many of our kids. That's why it's so important that we get to them and reduce the dropout rates and increase the graduation rates.
So how did the military change you?
Well, as I said, I think it brought some structure to me. I realized that there was something beyond 125th Street and Amsterdam Avenue in the world. I got to see people that were older than me and what they did or did not do with their lives. And, you know, I just matured, I think.
And after the military, you decided to go back to school?
Well, I finished my high school in the military. You know, I got the GED diploma. And when I came out, I went to Columbia University and matriculated there on the GI Bill. And I guess that's one of the stories I'm trying to tell with the book, that only in this country, I think, can people redeem themselves again, you know, have second and third chances to really straighten themselves out.
Do you think that it's possible for the schools to really change before society does? You know, as long as there's the kind of poverty and hopelessness and crime and drugs in the neighborhoods that schools are in, can the schools really protect kids from it?
It's very hard because schools, after all, merely reflect what's going on in society, particularly in the communities that the schools are. But I think we can't help but hope and fight for that. I'm the eternal optimist. I'm very hopeful that with this new administration that we have that education will become a focus. We know, for example, Head Start programs. We know they work. Everyone knows they work. And yet only 40% of the eligible students are getting access to Head Start. And this administration, for example, has indicated that they're going to fully fund it. That's a very key step. So there's different ways that the federal government can really help to push this agenda along. But we need that same sense of urgency that we had with Desert Storm and that we have with this SNL you know, issue, that we need the same kind of sense of urgency we had back in Sputnik if we're going to turn our schools around.
After the principal from the Red Hook School was shot and killed, mm-hmm. did you go to any of the schools afterwards and talk directly with students or teachers?
Yeah, in fact, I went to Mr. Daly's school, and we have intervention teams that we send to the schools when something like this happens. He's to train counselors to help students and faculty and parents deal with the grief. It's a very emotional experience that that they go through. It's very emotional, very heart-wringing experience. The students, first of all, don't understand why it happens. The teachers, the parents. And I went along with the mayor. We went and we spoke to the parents. We spoke to students in the classes. We visited the classes. We then walked together along with the parents over to the projects, to the spot where he was killed. That's one of the toughest things, I think, for me to deal with, when a student or a teacher or another employee get injured like that. It's very hard. There's no training for that.
When you got involved in education, did you ever think you'd be involved with murders and guns and police in the schools?
Not really. You know, and that's another one of the things that I think our colleges are looking at in terms of training our teachers. That's why it's so important to train our teachers in terms of resolving conflicts, so they know how to deal with their students in a way that it shows the students that there's other ways of dealing with your problems besides violence. We have to train our teachers in multicultural concepts, because more often than not, the training programs don't take that into consideration. So this a whole thing of training and retraining your staff members in terms of preparing them for what's actually in the schools today.
Joseph Fernandez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Joseph Fernandez is the chancellor of New York City's public schools and author of the new memoir, Tales Out of School. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.